Good evening, everyone. I'm Pastor Tim Westermeyer, the senior pastor of St. Philip the Deacon, which is privileged to host these community events called the Faith and Life Lecture Series. So welcome to all of you who are here in the sanctuary, and a special welcome to those of you who are joining us digitally for the second of our event of our 22nd season, which I find astonishing. So good to have you all here. I always do like to ask at the beginning of this, and obviously if you're at home, you can't raise your hand, or you can, but I won't be able to see it. Are any of you here for the first time to a Faith and Life event? Okay, so quite a few. So special welcome to all of you. We're grateful for your presence. Just a word about our flow. I'll introduce our speaker in a minute. After he comes up, he'll speak for 40, 45 minutes. After that, there will be an opportunity for questions from all of you. So if you're here in the sanctuary, I would invite you at that point to a microphone to my right or to my left, where you can ask the question directly. If you are at home or your cabin or somewhere else around the world and you want to submit a question, you can submit one in the box on our player there, which I think there's a box inviting your question, or you can email one to social@spdlc.org, social@spdlc.org, and depending on how the questioning goes, we will try to fit in as many of those as we can. I mentioned that this is the 22nd season of these wonderful events, and over that time we have had the privilege of hosting academics, historians, scientists, musicians, athletes, authors, business and nonprofit leaders to talk about how faith is connected to their own work. Over that time, we have also invited periodically theologians, although not routinely. Honestly, mostly we have lay people come. Tonight is an exception. We have a theologian and author. He happens to be perhaps the world's preeminent scholar on a beloved author of the 20th century, namely C.S. Lewis. And to give you just two examples of why that is the case, or to underscore that, one, he discovered, and I don't know if he'll talk about this tonight or not, he discovered what most would acknowledge now as the interpretive key to C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, which would be sufficient for anyone's career. And in part as a response to that, he was invited on November 22nd, 2013, which is the 50th anniversary of C.S. Lewis's death, to unveil the plaque commemorating C.S. Lewis at Poets' Corner in Westminster Abbey. So that's a huge honor, it strikes me, and we talked about that a little bit earlier today. What you may not know about him, is anyone a James Bond fan? Does anyone remember the movie The World Is Not Enough with Pierce Brosnan? Yeah? He makes an appearance in that. Yes. He was an assistant to Q. I believe he handed Q something. So check that out if you want. After you go home tonight, you can pull it up. More recently, he also played a speaking part. He's expanding his acting roles. He was the priest or the pastor of C.S. Lewis in the movie The Most Reluctant Convert. Did anyone see that? Yeah. Another thing that he will now be able to add to his CV after tonight related to this series is this is true, I'm not making this up, he is now only the third person to come for a repeat performance at Faith and Life. The other two were Brené Brown and Bishop Michael Curry. We are delighted to welcome Michael Ward.
Thank you, Tim. Good evening, everybody. I'm glad to be with you on what is a very brief in and out visit. I arrived last night and I leave tomorrow. So I will have been on the ground for only one full day in Minneapolis. But thank you for having me. Having me again. It was 2009, I think I was here last time. And a lot has happened since then. Though, in fact, what Tim mentioned about my appearance in the James Bond movie had already happened by then. Yes, I handed Pierce Brosnan a pair of X-ray specs in that movie. And what I'm going to offer you tonight, if we can get this PowerPoint working, is X-ray vision into Lewis's book, The Abolition of Man. Maybe I just need to disconnect and reconnect.
Of heaven is the place where there are no lighting or sound issues, and that is now being confirmed yet again. Have you tried? Okay, that looks cool.
If in doubt, disconnect and reconnect. Ah. There we are. So we're going to be talking tonight about the abolition of man, which is Lewis's most philosophical work and also his most prophetic work. But is it Christian? The answer to that question is yes, it is Christian, don't worry. What we're really going to get into is how it is Christian. Hello, I'm just waving at my godson, Henry Starkey, who, and his new wife, Gabrielle. They've just driven up from New Ulm. Good to see you. So, the abolition of man. Here it is. Here's a cover of a recent edition of the book. Brought out, incidentally, to coincide with my new guide to the book, After Humanity. I've made a special study of this book because it is so difficult, and I have noticed how many of my students have found it hard to get into. I myself have found it hard to get it into. I'm no philosopher myself, and so I wrote this guide largely to teach myself what Lewis is up to in this book. The Abolition of Man originated as a series of philosophical lectures given by Lewis during the Second World War. They were part of an annual series called the Riddle Memorial Lectures. And each lecture each year was asked to address a subject concerning the relation between religion and contemporary development of thought. And Lewis's lectures were the 15th series. They were entitled Men Without Chests on the first night, The Way on the second night, and then The Abolition of Man on the third night, three consecutive presentations. And in these lectures, Lewis defends the objectivity of value. In other words, when we say something is good or true or beautiful, when we're assigning value to a thing, what we're doing is saying, if we're correct, that the goodness, the truth, and the beauty is really in the object, in the thing, in the person, whatever it may be. It's not just something that we subjectively confer, but it's something we recognize, we discern it. We don't create value, we recognize value. And Lewis's point is that the objectivity of value is maintained in all great philosophical and religious traditions throughout the world, throughout down through history. There is a universal moral law which we have a responsibility to hand on to our children, this generous and fruitful and civilizing inheritance of our humanity. And if we cease to believe in objective value, and if we fail to pass it on to the next generation, then we will be effectively bringing about our own abolition. It's a short book. Not much more than an extended essay, really, only about 20,000 words in length. And as I said, it's Lewis's most purely philosophical work, and it is very dense. It's short, but dense. This time next week, it will be Thanksgiving, won't it? And we will have all fed our bodies, possibly too much. So in order to limber up for next week's feast for the body, tonight I'm going to offer you what I hope will be a kind of feast for the mind. We will have to put on our thinking caps and strap ourselves in, because it is a difficult work. And for that reason, it's never going to be one of Lewis's most popular works. It's not going to, you know, be a bestseller like the Narnia Chronicles or Mere Christianity. But nonetheless, it is a very highly regarded book. Lewis himself described it as almost my favorite among my books. And it does connect to so many key areas of Lewis's output as a writer. And it's been highly praised by all sorts of different people, all across the Christian spectrum, and indeed outside the Christian world too. The contemporary British philosopher, John Gray, calls the book prophetic, prescient, as relevant now as when it first came out, if not more so. But interestingly, John Gray is an atheist. John Gray has no belief in God, let alone the Christian God. But he recently presented on the BBC radio a whole program devoted to the abolition of man and why he thought it was so important. Now, why would an atheist give such warm approval to an argument from C.S. Lewis, the noted Christian apologist and evangelist? I ask that question not to imply that, you know, an atheist could never find value in a Christian's work any more than I'd want to imply that a Christian could never find value in an atheist's work. But I ask the question in order to foreground, really, what is one of the most important points about the abolition of man, namely that it is not, in fact, explicitly a Christian argument. It's entirely compatible with Christianity, but as Lewis says in the course of the book, though I am myself a theist and indeed a Christian, I'm not here attempting any even indirect argument for theism. In other words, the argument he's presenting here doesn't rest on belief in God. It's compatible with belief in God, and of course Lewis wants to ultimately argue for belief in God and Christianity, but in this book he's setting his sights much lower. He's not attempting even an indirect argument for theism, let alone a direct argument for Christianity. So if he's not attempting a religious argument, what is he attempting? Well, he's attempting simply to demonstrate that all human beings consider certain states of affairs or certain modes of conduct good in and of themselves. They are objectively good. And to support that claim, he quotes any number of sources from Plato and Aristotle to the Old Testament, to the New Testament, to early Hinduism, to Native American traditions, to Aboriginal Australian traditions. In an appendix to the book, he provides a list of 8 key moral laws, such as duties to one's elders and ancestors, duties to one's children and posterity, the duty of truth-telling, the law of magnanimity, and so on. He gives all these moral laws, and then he supports them with quotations from all these different traditions across the world and down through history. But interestingly, he doesn't say, what I'm presenting for you here is natural law. That would be an obvious term to deploy if he was indeed explicitly making a Christian argument. And nor does Lewis ever once refer to the chief exponent of natural law thinking in the Christian tradition, namely Thomas Aquinas. Interestingly, Lewis doesn't even draw upon the key biblical text that a lot of people turn to when talking about natural law, which is from the second chapter of the letter to the Romans, where you remember Paul, the Apostle Paul, says that when the Gentiles, which have not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, these, having not the law, are a law unto themselves, which show the work of the law written in their hearts. That's the King James Version of that verse from Romans 2. So if Lewis is not going to call this universal objective moral tradition natural law, what is he going to call it? And interestingly, he selects a Chinese term, the Tao. He says this: the Chinese also speak of a great thing, the greatest thing, called the Tao. It is the reality beyond all predicates. It is the way in which the universe goes on, the way which every man should tread, conforming all activities to that great exemplar. This conception, in all its forms, Platonic, Aristotelian, Stoic, Christian, and Oriental alike, I shall henceforth refer to for brevity simply as the Tao. Now, this is a very deliberate rhetorical strategy. By choosing this Chinese term, Lewis is wrong-footing those who might assume that this argument is going to be just another standard argument for natural law presented in Christian terms, arguing from Christian premises to Christian conclusions. And to many readers who come to the Abolition of Man after encountering Lewis's more obviously and avowedly Christian books like Mere Christianity, the Abolition of Man feels slightly unexpected. It disconcerts people to find Jesus being quoted in the same breath as Confucius. What's going on? Well, actually, it should come as no surprise if we know C.S. Lewis, because he had made very similar points about how different religious traditions, different philosophical traditions, overlap a great deal in their moral code. He'd made that point in several places in his writings. For instance, in his first book of Christian apologetics, The Problem of Pain, he says, "What is common to Zarathustra, Jeremiah, Socrates, Gautama, Christ, and Marcus Aurelius is something pretty substantial." And then in a footnote, he adds, "I mention the incarnate God among human teachers to emphasize the fact that the principal difference between him and them lies not in ethical teaching, which is here my concern, but in person and office." So he's quite clear that he's only arguing for the objectivity of value. The question as to whether this position implies a supernatural origin for the Tao is a question I'm not here concerned with. And if you are concerned to see how he proceeds when that is his concern, reread the opening chapters of Mere Christianity. Right and wrong as a clue to the meaning of the universe. Because in Mere Christianity, Lewis starts out with a very similar argument about the objectivity of value, but in that book, he proceeds to the supernatural origin for it, to God, and then to Christ, who reveals God to us definitively. But it's this resolutely non-religious framework that is one of the major reasons why the Abolition of Man has appealed to such a broad readership, including atheists like John Gray, because the book propounds an argument that doesn't require its adherents to be signed up members of a particular religious confession. Now, I emphasize this point for two reasons. First, because far too much of the commentary on the Abolition of Man rather lazily conflates it with Mere Christianity, but the two books are different, and we shouldn't fold one into the other. Of course, there's a lot of similarity between them, but they are distinct, and it's important to keep them distinct. This lecture series is Faith and Life. And remember, Lewis was a philosopher. That was much of part of his academic life, his career. And he wanted, obviously, his faith to inform his life, but he wanted his faith to inform his philosophizing in a philosophical manner and not to collapse philosophy into theology. The second reason for emphasizing that the Abolition of Man is not an explicitly Christian work is to clarify his point about the universality of the objective of the objectivity of value. People really can and do come to moral conclusions very similar to those of Christianity, without being Christians. In an address to the Oxford Socratic Club, that was the debating society in Oxford, which Lewis was president of for many years, Lewis said that Christian moral principles aren't different from moral principles. The real problem is how to obey moral principles. And this view is certainly not unique to C.S. Lewis. One of the highest ranking people to praise the Abolition of Man was Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who later became Pope Benedict XVI. And Ratzinger says, very similarly, that the moral vision of Christian faith is not something particularly Christian. Rather, it is the synthesis of the great moral intuitions of humanity from a new center which holds them all together. That new center is Jesus Christ. The person and the office of Jesus are what make him remarkable, not so much the content of his teaching. how we obey the law, and why we obey the law. Those are the things that Christ enables us to do and to understand. So the abolition of man is not, in the ordinary sense of the word, a religious work. It's moral or ethical or philosophical, yes, but not strictly speaking religious or Christian. Though Lewis himself was a great Christian writer, he didn't always feel the need to operate from a strictly Christian viewpoint. He looked for points of contact with other perspectives. Indeed, he saw this as essential to the enterprise of sharing the faith. He once said that the only possible basis for Christian apologetics is a proper respect for paganism. The only possible basis for Christian apologetics is a proper respect for paganism. To respect paganism, you must literally look back at it. That's what respect means. You must, as it were, look into the eyes of your non-believing friends. You must meet their gaze, and by looking into their eyes and seeing what they mean when they say something, you might discover that what they mean is very similar to, perhaps identical with, what you mean by it. They could use different language, but they might mean something very similar. And those similarities need to be acknowledged, partly out of basic honesty and politeness, but partly also because a recognition of such similarities can be useful, can be a step towards political and social and indeed, finally, religious and spiritual harmony. Christians don't always need to be harping on the distinctives of Christianity. Sometimes it's worth looking at the points of overlap. Now, if it's surprising to find this great Christian apologist not explicitly defending Christianity in this book, well, it's perhaps equally surprising to find a Riddle Memorial lecturer not focusing on religion, because after all, those lectures, that lecture series was devised to establish, to address a subject concerning the relation between religion and contemporary development of thought. Where then does religion feature in Lewis's argument? He said that his abolition lectures were a work of ethics, not theology. Has he then failed to observe the terms of his lectureship? Should he have given the money back that he received for giving these lectures? Where does religion come into the case that he presents? Well, in one obvious way, it features in the appendix. Many of the traditions that Lewis cites in supporting those eight moral laws are traditions that are religious. And some are theistic, some are polytheistic, some are Christian. And insofar as these religious traditions are being undermined by subjectivism, the belief that values are not objective, insofar as those religions are being undermined by that contemporary development of thought, well, Lewis's lectures satisfy the conditions of the Riddle Memorial lectures well enough. In a less obvious way, but possibly more important way, Lewis may have felt that he could fulfill the conditions of the lecture series by taking that word religion in its strict etymological sense. Religion, religion, think of ligature or a ligament. Religion means literally a binding together, a binding back up. And in that sense of the word religion, the abolition of man could be characterized very rightly as a profoundly religious argument, because behind the diversity of all these moral traditions that Lewis cites lies a strong, central, unifying principle, namely the belief in or the recognition of objective value. It's this belief in objective value that precedes what we normally refer to as religion, you know, Buddhism, Islam, Christianity, whatever it may be. Recognition of objective value is a kind of religion, a basic foundational religion underlying all religions and indeed all traditional and logical philosophies of thought whatsoever. You can only be a follower of a religion, Lewis is saying, if you're a human being first. And it's this acceptance of objective value that makes us human. Long before we are Stoic or Native American or Aristotelian or Platonist or Christian or humanist, we are human by dint of this belief that value is out there and we can discover it. Without such a shared premise as a bedrock, we can't dispute matters rationally with each other. We can only assert our particular subjective preferences and try to shout down those whose preferences differ from our own. To deny this core principle of objective value is to deny what makes us members of the human family. It leads to the law of the jungle. Yet another way in which we could consider the abolition of man in a religious light is by reference to the question of foundations or preconditions. Excuse me. We should believe Lewis when he says that he's not attempting even an indirect argument for theism, but nonetheless, he certainly saw that belief in objective value is a precondition for theism and Christianity. Of course it is. He makes this clear in the letter of 1953. He says, I believe we ought to work not only at spreading the gospel, that certainly, but also a certain preparation for the gospel. It's necessary to recall many to the law of nature before we talk about God. For Christ promises forgiveness of sins. But what is that to those who, since they do not know the law of nature, do not know that they have sinned? Who will take medicine unless he knows he's in the grip of disease? Moral relativity is the enemy we have to overcome before we tackle atheism. So we see here that Lewis believed acceptance of objective value to be the foundation stone of both theism and Christianity. Once you're a believer in objective value, then you at least have the foundations in place to go on to believing in God and in Christ. But only if you attempt seriously to live in accordance with the objective values that you perceive. He wrote in 1950 to a correspondent, "The attempt to practice the Tao is certainly the right line." This friend, by the way, was on the brink of becoming a Christian. "The attempt to practice the Tao is certainly the right line. Have you read the Analects of Confucius?" He ends up by saying, "This is the Tao. I do not know if anyone has ever kept it." That's significant. One can really go from there direct to the Epistle to the Romans. And I presume that Lewis has in mind here verses like Romans 3:23 and Romans 7:24 as key points of contact between Confucius's observation and Christianity. Remember what Paul says in those verses from Romans. "For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God." Nobody has ever kept it. But then Paul adds, "O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from this body of death? I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord." Believe in objective value, yes. Recognize that you don't live up to objective value. Look for help. And that help, if looked for honestly and consistently, will lead you to Christ. And we can observe that very progression in Lewis's own life. It was only after attempting to obey his own conscience for a year and failing, finding that he couldn't live up even to his own standards that he recognized as objectively demanding his obedience. It was only after a year of doing that Lewis realized he did not of himself have the resources to live in a morally upright way, and consequently threw himself on the mercy of Christ and the power of the Holy Spirit. Ethical behavior, moral behavior, is always in the long run, if honestly and wholeheartedly undertaken, directed towards Christianity. He puts it like this in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy. You must not even try to do the will of the Father unless you are prepared to know of the doctrine. He's quoting there John 7:17. In other words, if you try to do what God has revealed to all humanity about moral upright behavior, if you try to do that, eventually you will come to know of the doctrine. You will come to an acceptance of Christianity, and you need to be prepared for that. So we can say of the abolition of man that although it's not a directly and explicitly Christian apologetic, it can be properly considered from the author's own admission as a kind of pre-apologetic. It's trying to get people to first base, so to speak. You can only be a Christian if you're a human being first. So let's sit down and try to establish what it means to be a human being. That's effectively what Lewis is up to. And one of the things it means to be a human being is to have an awareness, both of the moral law and of your failure to keep the moral law. Conscience and guilt and shame that follow from transgressing conscience are universal human experiences, and quite properly so. There's one more way in which there's a religious dimension to this book. It's subtler, more implicit. And that has to do with Lewis's picture of the human person as a composite reality. He has this picture of the human person in three parts: the head, the belly, and the chest. That's his model, his philosophical model of the human person. In our heads, we think. In our bellies, we feel. And in our chests, we integrate thought and feeling. He says this: the head rules the belly through the chest being the seat of magnanimity, of emotions organized by trained habit into stable sentiments. The chest, magnanimity, sentiment, these are the indispensable liaison officers between cerebral man and visceral man. It may even be said that it is by this middle element that man is man, for by his intellect he's mere spirit, and by his appetite mere animal. At the core of the book, then, is this claim in what you would call, if you wanted to be technical, philosophical anthropology. Anthropology, the study of man, what makes us human. And to Lewis, it is the chest that makes us human. Without the chest, we either evaporate upwards into a kind of false spirituality, as if we were angels, as if we weren't embodied creatures, or we devolve downwards into mere animality. But combine the angelic part of ourselves with the animal part of ourselves, and you have the anthropological. Combine the brain and the belly in the human breast, and you have the human being. Connect the cerebral and the visceral, and you have the truly human. It is the chest which Lewis calls the seat of magnanimity. Magnanimous, literally great-souled. An angel has a rational soul, and a beast has a sensitive soul, but human beings have both reason and sense. The human soul is therefore the great soul, the soul that interlocks spirit with matter, intellect with sensation. And that magnanimity in Lewis's model of the human person resides in our chest, in our heart. Now, all this is getting probably a little bit heavy and dense, so let's have a little comic interlude. Amusingly, as I was Googling Lewis, men without chests, you've got to be very careful what you Google these days. I came across this image. Now, you perhaps know that C.S. Lewis was always known as Jack Lewis. He didn't like the name Clive Staples, so he was always known as Jack. And here is another man called Jack Lewis, an old-time strong man from the east of London, and you can perhaps just make out in his sort of business card, it says, "Be strong, keep strong, by using the Jack Lewis Improved Progressive Expander. It will fortify your body with powerful muscles and strengthen your internal organs and enable you to defy disease." Now, if I were to sum up in a single sentence the main thrust of the abolition of man, it would be expand your chest, become more human, integrate your thinking and your feeling more adequately. And ironically, C.S. Lewis's own chest, when he was a little boy, here is Lewis as about 8 or 9 year old kid, his chest was something of great concern, both to his doctor and to his father. Lewis had lost his mother when he was still a young boy. And in a letter home from school, he was sent to a boarding school, when he was about 15, Lewis wrote back to his dad saying, "I've been condemned by the school doctor to join the ranks of people who do special exercises for delicate chests in the gym." And his father said, "I've never known a boy with a weaker chest." And then when Lewis went to Oxford, he began, at least briefly, to learn to row, to join the crew on the river. And his dad was delighted. His father remarked, saying that rowing is the very best exercise for putting a chest on a man. Now, I don't know whether this physiological, medical concern Lewis had for his own chest contributed to his development of the idea of the chest as the definitively human capacity, but it's an interesting coincidence. And if we turn for a moment to Lewis's fiction and the Narnia Chronicles, it's interesting that the chest appears even there. In The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, you might remember that Peter Pevensey, King Peter, becomes by the end of the story a tall and deep-chested man. And in the final chronicle of Narnia, The Last Battle, there's this ape character called Shift, an evil ape who ushers in a kind of antichrist. And we're told in the course of that novel what weak chests apes always have. Apes can imitate humans, but they can't be humans because they have weak chests. And by giving up on the chest, we have arrived at the situation that Lewis defines and describes in the first of his three lectures, which you remember is called Men Without Chests, which gives us one of the most memorable and certainly one of the most memeable lines of the entire book. "We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and bid the geldings be fruitful." We make men without chests. The reason and the passion in us are at odds, and no rapprochement is possible unless we build strength in the liaison officer between spirit and matter, between thinking and sensation. And it's that stalemate, that failure, that Lewis seeks to overcome with his emphasis upon this middle element. Exactly how the chest integrates thinking and feeling is something mysterious, but we all know it from within. We all know what it is to say to ourselves when we're in the grip of a passion, I need to be self-controlled. And contrariwise, sometimes when we need to gin up our enthusiasm for something, we say to ourselves, come on, get with the program. And that's our head ruling our belly through the chest. And if we try and climb out of that nature that we find ourselves within, we will effectively be undercutting our own identity as human beings. We'll either, as I say, be evaporating upwards into false spirituality or devolving downwards into excessive animality. Now, the reason I suggest that this emphasis upon the chest is a sort of subtle and implicit Christian apologetic is because of what Lewis says elsewhere in another work called, interestingly, just Christian Apologetics. And in that essay, he says that the combining of the head and the belly is very important in the religious context. He says this: "We may divide religions, as we do soups, into thick and clear. By thick, I mean those which have orgies and ecstasies and mysteries and local attachments. Africa is full of thick religions. By clear, I mean those which are philosophical, ethical, and universalizing. Stoicism, Buddhism, and the ethical church are clear religions. Now, if there is a true religion, it must be both thick and clear. For the true God must have made both the child and the man, both the savage and the citizen, both the head and the belly. And he goes on to say that in his view, the only two religions that come close to fulfilling this condition are Hinduism and Christianity. But Hinduism, he says, fulfills it imperfectly. Christianity, on the other hand, really does break down the middle wall, the partition between the head and the belly. It takes a convert, this I'm now quoting Lewis, it takes a convert, Christianity takes a convert from Central Africa and tells him to obey an enlightened, universal ethic. It takes a 20th century academic prig like me, this is still Lewis speaking, and tells me to go fasting to a mystery to drink the blood of the Lord. The savage convert has to be clear, I have to be thick. That is how one knows one has come to the real religion. That's Christianity. So what is he saying? He's saying, as we've seen, that all great religious traditions are by definition human by virtue of the fact that they recognize objective value. Here in Christian apologetics, he goes a step further and claims that that re-ligamenting, that binding together of head and belly, is achieved most fully in Christianity. But that claim is already implicit in the abolition of man, I think. And I say that because there's a repeated discussion in the course of the abolition of man of how you really know when you believe in objective value. You believe in objective value when you are prepared to pay a price for it. Because until you have to pay a price for your belief in its objectivity, well, how do you know you really believe in its objectivity? It's just convenient, isn't it? But when you have to pay a price, and you're still willing to go through with your belief, well, then obviously that clearly reveals that it is to you objective. And Lewis gets at this point by repeatedly referring to that old Latin tag from the Roman writer Horace, Dulce et decorum est, pro patria mori. It's sweet and seemly to die for your country. Lewis says this, when a Roman father told his son that it was a sweet and seemly thing to die for his country, he believed what he said. He was communicating to the son an emotion which he himself shared and which he believed to be in accord with the value which his judgment discerned in noble death. He was giving the boy the best he had, giving of his spirit to humanize him as he had given of his body to beget him. It's hard to believe that it's sweet and seemly to die for your country. It's obviously not literally true that it's sweet to die for your country, as Lewis says, because death is not something to eat, and therefore cannot be dulce, cannot be sweet in the literal sense. And it's unlikely that death for your country and the real sensations preceding your death for your country will be sweet even by analogy. As for decorum, as for it being seemly, well, he says that's only a word describing how some other people will feel about your death when they happen to think of it, which won't be often and will certainly do you no good. One of the reasons why Lewis focuses in on this quotation from Horace may well be that it had come under attack in after the First World War. The great English war poet Wilfred Owen had written a poem called Dulce et Decorum Est, in which he had described it as a great lie. It wasn't sweet and seemly to die for your country. It was horrible, painful, pointless. 750,000 British servicemen were killed in the 1914-18 war. And Lewis himself was very nearly one of them. This is the only photograph of Lewis in uniform. He was a second lieutenant in the British Army. And he was very nearly killed in the spring of 1918 when a shell fell in his trench and killed the man next to him and spattered Lewis full of shrapnel, bits of which he carried around in his body for years afterwards. and he had a kind of out-of-body experience after he'd been hit. He thought he was no longer breathing, and he concluded that he was therefore dying. So Lewis knew up close and personal what it was to see men die for their country. He came very close to dying for his country himself. So when he talks about the sweetness and fittingness of death for a good cause, he's aware that it doesn't refer to the subjective experience of the persons dying on the battlefield. They don't find it sweet and seemly. Nonetheless, it is sweet and seemly because it is objectively sweet and seemly. It's an objective statement, about a reality beyond one's immediate sensations and beyond one's immediate interests. It's good to give yourself for the sake of other people, even to die for other people at the extremity. And this willingness to suffer in defense of objective value, Lewis describes as the experimentum crucis, the critical experiment of your belief in objective value. But it's important to observe, and we're getting close to the end now, it's important to observe how in The Abolition of Man, Lewis doesn't just talk about the Roman writer Horace, sweet and seemly to die for your country. He cleverly and subtly drops in alongside the discussion from this ancient Roman source, the words of Jesus, that it is that greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. Look at this quotation from The Abolition of Man. An innovator in values, that is to say a subjectivist, someone who doesn't believe in objective value, regards dulce et decorum and greater love hath no man as mere irrational sentiments, which are to be stripped off in order that we may get down to the realistic or basic ground of this value. So you can see how Lewis slips in alongside Horace the words of Jesus. He's focusing mostly on the pagan writer because he's speaking philosophically and wanting to find points of overlap. But he's clearly seeing that there's a corresponding statement in Christian teaching, which is essentially the same. Horace and Christ saw the same truth. And the fact that death for a good cause usually involves pain explains why it is the critical experiment of an ethical system. For as long as our moral choices are painless, it's hard to tell whether we are truly undertaking them for their own sake or not. And this is a point that Lewis zooms in on in his book, The Problem of Pain. He says there, we agree with Aristotle that what is intrinsically right may well be agreeable, and that the better a man is, the more he will like it. But we also agree with Kant, Immanuel Kant, so far as to say that there is one right act, that of self-surrender, which cannot be willed to the height by fallen creatures unless it is unpleasant. The doctrine of death, which I describe, is not peculiar to Christianity. Nature herself has written it large across the world in the repeated drama of the buried seed and the re-arising corn. We cannot escape the doctrine by ceasing to be Christians. It is an eternal gospel revealed to men wherever men have sought or endured the truth, the unescapable knowledge which the light that lighteneth every man presses down upon the minds of all who seriously question what the universe is about. And this belief in the ethical universality of painful self-surrender helps explain the way Lewis concludes The Abolition of Man in that appendix that I've talked about several times. The very final citation that Lewis gives in the appendix to the book comes from our Lord Jesus Christ himself in the Gospel according to John. Verily, verily, I say unto you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. He who loves his life loses it. So The Abolition of Man ends on a note of death, but of good death, as do so many of Lewis's works, by the way. if we are to avoid the abolition predicted in his book, there are many and various traditions of wisdom on which we could draw, as the appendix shows. But the only one of those traditions which will enable us to die out of love freely by imitating Christ is Christianity, where the moral chest has found its fullest development. In a sense, then, the message of the abolition of man is that we all need chest expanders, and Jack Lewis is ready to supply them. Prepare yourself for a shocking image. We mustn't have an excess of the belly. We must keep our passions in order. Sensation, appetite, they are good, but they must be kept in check. But in getting our belly, our passions in shape, we mustn't think that we can just lose weight and work on the chest. This image represents no improvement, not really, on that image. Why not? Well, okay, the belly is nicely controlled, but where is the head? The head doesn't appear in this picture. The head is missing. We need a head as well as a chest and a belly. The head rules the belly through the chest. The chest is the indispensable liaison officer between cerebral man and visceral man. The chest is the seat of magnanimity, the great soul that defines our humanity. And of all attempts to be human, the greatest is that of Jesus himself. And when a Christian looks at this image, it is but a short step to this image. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. Unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, if it pays a price for the belief in objective value, it will bear much fruit. So it is to Jesus Christ, crucified and risen from the dead, that Lewis would have us look if we are truly seeking after humanity. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael, for that feast for our heads, as you say. I'm going to let him rest his voice for a moment. I'll lift up a few things. And then, again, there will be a chance for questions. If you're here, again, I will remind you of Mike to my right and to my left if you're at home. Again, you can include a question in the box on the screen or send an email to social@spdlc.org. First thing I'll say is if you are here, I'm looking out at the table, we do have some books available. Either Planet Narnia or After Humanity. I was with Michael earlier today at the University of Minnesota, where he also gave a talk, and he mentioned that those are his two favorite books that he wrote. Best books, I think you said, yeah? I can commend both of them to you. So if you'd like to pick one up and have him inscribe it, go to the back afterwards, and he will be happy to do that. I want to make sure you're all aware of the next, the third event in this year's season, which is with the former Major League Baseball player and one-time St. Paul Saint, Daryl Strawberry. So we'll get through the end of the year and the beginning of the next year, so he will join us on February 6th here again in the sanctuary, and that again is free and open to the public, 7 o'clock. Please join us for that. Follow us on all of the social media things or subscribe to our email if you'd like reminders about those future events. And then the final thing I will say, just a reminder of our deep thanks for everyone who makes these events possible. I say this at every event, but this is not a budget item of this congregation. From its inception 22 years ago, these events have been funded entirely by individuals and local corporations who feel that these are important community events. And through the generosity of these individuals, we're able to bring wonderful speakers like Michael here to this place. You see, I hope all of the names of our funders for this year here, but I will lift up our corporate sponsors, Crossroads Financial, Cressa, Mally Design, Mastercraft Labels, The Valuation Group, Productivity Inc., Rapid Packaging, and Bay Creek Dental. Many of our sponsors are here this evening. Will you join me in thanking them? I also want to say a word of thanks, as always, to our friend Jeff Elstad for his music before and following the event. Jeff, thank you very, very much. And now I'm going to invite Michael back up to take a few of your questions. And I do have a few from our online viewers already, but if someone has one you'd like to ask, please come to the mics.
Hi, Michael.
Yes, hello.
Great discussion. So I just want to, you'd mentioned his service in World War I, and I know how harrowing that was. I also read something like of his classmates at Oxford that entered the war like in their late teens to early 20s. You know, almost everyone died beyond C.S. Lewis. And I'm wondering, you know, there's that old saying, there are no atheists in a foxhole. And yet, that whole experience of almost dying, and yet he kind of remained, you can correct me if I'm wrong, kind of an atheist for a while, or perhaps didn't embrace Christianity for quite a bit later in his life. And maybe you could just comment a little bit about that.
Yeah, thank you. That is a common saying, isn't it? There are no atheists in foxholes. And I think possibly Lewis is directly alluding to that when I think it is in a letter written around that time, shortly after the war. Someone asks him, were you afraid in the trenches of France? And he said, yes, all the time. But I never sank so low as to pray. That was when he was still, you know, a fairly thoroughgoing atheist. Now, maybe that just speaks to Lewis's mental consistency, that he believed that there was no God to be prayed to, however much he might want and need a God to be prayed to, and therefore he wasn't going to pray to such a non-existent entity. Of course, most atheists are not that consistent. Because the need overpowers our, you know, their existing atheistical beliefs. But I mentioned that just as a curious example of how very atheistical Lewis was in those years. For really about 20 years of his life, he was calling himself an unbeliever. And he came back only painfully and slowly. He says in his autobiography that he was brought kicking and struggling into the kingdom of God. The most dejected and reluctant convert in all England, he said of himself when he became a theist, and he didn't much want to become a Christian either. But I think that speaks to the depth of the reality of his conversion when it finally came about. Walter Hooper, who knew Lewis in the last few months of his life and became the great editor and biographer of the man, Walter Hooper said of C.S. Lewis that he was the most converted man that he ever met. And one can see that could well have been true. Lewis let no part of his faith, let no part of his life remain untouched by his faith. Remarkable, saintly man. And yet one who, I think, almost deliberately tried to avoid appearing like a saint. You know, with all his beer drinking and his love of off-color humor and things like that, he didn't want to come over as sort of pious and proper. He saw no reason why Christians should be, you know, respectable in that kind of middle-class way. I mean, think of some of the great saints in Christian history, from Paul onwards, who have been rather rugged individuals. We don't need to be all terribly spruce in our ties and white collars. So I don't know if that answers your question, but thank you for it anyway. Yes, sir.
Reference was made to the prophetic nature of the abolition of man and ways in which it is perhaps more relevant now than ever. I wonder if you could specifically address how Lewis's arguments and the situation in which he was presenting them are relevant today. What's going on in the 20th century with men with or without chests?
Thank you. Yes, good question. It was only a few years ago, wasn't it? I think 2016, that the Oxford English Dictionary listed as its word of the year, it does this every year, singles out a particular word that's become prominent in the preceding 12 months. In 2016, the word of the year was post-truth. Post-truth. We now live in a post-truth generation or society or culture. What does that mean, post-truth? Well, it basically means what Lewis was predicting. Radical subjectivism, a radical sort of belief that value in itself does not exist. It's not discoverable. It's not really out there. Truth is something we make up. Truth is something we decide to be true. We don't discover it to be true. And therefore, my truth may well differ from your truth. And so speak your truth, you know, show yourself to be who you really are. And if that conflicts with who I am, well, that's a bit awkward, but that's what we have to accept. Because there is no such thing as truth with a capital T that we all have to accept. No, the best we can do is this sort of tolerance. We can tolerate, hopefully, other people's truths, except when they conflict with ours too painfully. And then there's no real rational resolution to be arrived at. That's when it all comes down to power and the will to power, which Lewis also talks about a bit in the third of the three lectures. Because if there's no truth that we can reasonably approach and persuade one another to approach more closely, well then, how can we resolve our difficulties except by asserting our own strength? And might becomes right, which is, you know, the law of the jungle, as I was saying. Nature is red in tooth and claw. There's no such thing as a rational and peaceable society if we give up on objective value, if we move into the post-truth world. So what Lewis describes in the 1940s was already beginning to, you know, take root in a new way. I mean, there's always been the tendency to assert our own perspective over reality. I mean, in a sense, it's a definition of sin, isn't it? From the Garden of Eden onwards. You know, did God really say? You know, is it really objective that you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree? No, it's not objective. I can make up my own rules. You know, that's subjectivism right from the start. It's a kind of definition of sin. But what makes it particularly a contemporary and pressing issue from the early 20th century onwards is our increasing reliance upon science and technology to subdue reality in service of whatever we want it to be. That's why it's an increasingly problematic issue. It's a perennial issue at the moral level, but just now practically, technologically, we can manipulate reality to serve us in new ways that were not available to previous generations. So it's that kind of issue which I think Lewis saw as coming down the pike. He had a very logical mind and could see where acceptance of new positions would eventually lead. And that, I think, is why the book is so prescient. Thank you for the question. Yes, sir.
Question? 16 years after he enlisted or was joined the service to go to World War I, September 19th and 20th, 1931, he left Magdalen, his residence, and met up with J.R.R. Tolkien and also a fellow named Dyson, who I don't think was in vacuum cleaners. But anyway.
What's the question, sir?
Well, they went on Addison's Walk
for
hours and hours. And that was one of the key times when critical to where he became a Christian and got the. And I'm just curious if whether, in fact, there is some records, contemporary records, of journals, diaries, whatever, about the relationship as it changed over the years between Jack and Dollar.
Between Jack and Tolkien? Yeah, there's a lot of material in their letters to each other, some of which have survived, and in accounts of their friendships and conversations. That particular conversation you're alluding to when Lewis was encouraged back into the Christian faith in 1931, there's a lot that we know about that, because Lewis wrote a long, detailed letter describing the conversation to another friend, in which he gave, you know, a great deal of insight into what it was that Tolkien and this other friend, Hugo Dyson, said to Lewis that enabled him to get over his remaining obstacles to accepting Christianity.
One of the key people in the what they call Inklings.
Yes.
And so there was about a baker's dozen or so, right?
People, sorry?
Members?
I'm not hearing you, sorry.
Of the Inklings?
Tolkien was one of the Inklings, yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There were about a dozen other people in that group.
Yes.
And it went on, but at first they were meeting one night a week for hours, then twice a week, and over the years, they started going three times a week.
Yes.
Spending hours and hours and hours together.
They did, the Inklings really grew out of the friendship between Lewis and Tolkien. That they began meeting together to discuss the writings that they were working on, and then other friends gradually accumulated around them. And yeah, they met for many, many years, usually on Tuesday mornings in the local pub called the Eagle and Child. And then on a Thursday evening in Lewis's college rooms. And that's those Thursday evening meetings where they would share their works in progress. And it was there that, you know, the first readings of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings were given.
Thank you for coming.
My pleasure. Thank you. Yes, sir.
With the previous question, you mentioned the evangelistic effectiveness of objectivity. Any wisdom on how to approach those conversations constructively in our current cultural moment?
Oof. Isn't it time to go and say? I don't know. I mean, I have a friend who teaches communication theory in Texas. And whenever I ask him about, you know, how to connect with a particular audience, how to make a point, he always says, it depends on the audience. It depends who you're speaking to. It depends on the individual. It depends what they can take. One particular point about objective value might well be, if someone is showing subjectivist tendencies, if they are beginning to imply that there is no such thing as truth with a capital T, then just probe them gently to see what values where they aren't content to say that. Because everybody eventually, however subjectivist they pretend they are, will eventually come down to saying, well, torturing children is actually wrong, with a capital W. And there's no conceivable world in which the torturing of the innocent is acceptable. Or, you know, whatever their favorite shibboleth might be. You know, some people are particularly up in arms about, you know, racism or sexism or environmental destruction or whatever it is. They might be prepared to say that, you know, abortion is fine, but then get them on question of torturing of women and forcible rape, and they say, well, that's not fine. Oh, so you do believe in objective value. And then they will have to reassess their premises. That's one way of doing it, and hopefully you can do it gently, without too much confrontation and offense. But eventually, you know, I think this is something that C.S. Lewis saw. Eventually, there is the scandal of the gospel. There is something about the truth that we do not like in our natural selves. And this is indeed one of the reasons why Lewis was so reluctant to become a Christian, because he didn't want to be interfered with. He was lawless and individualist. He was monstrous, he says, in his lawlessness and individualism. And submitting all of that to God and Christ was painful to him. It's painful to us all if we do it properly. And so we shouldn't unnecessarily provoke pain in those with whom we are sharing the faith. Thank you. Shall we make this the last question?
Well, let's do this one, and then I do want to ask at least one from our online. We have a number of online questions, and I'm not going to be able to get to all of them.
Let's have the last in-person question.
Yes, yes.
The abolition of man, you said, is in a sense prophetic. In other words, you know, if we don't watch out, this is what's going to happen, that kind of prophetic. But isn't some of his fiction the same way? I think of The Hideous Strength.
Oh, yes.
Even The Last Battle. Yes. And Screwtape Letters, even.
Yes.
So was that part of his thinking of recognizing that modern man is really off course and these are the kinds of things that could happen?
Yes. That Hideous Strength is, Lewis says, the fictional equivalent of The Abolition of Man. But you find the same sorts of ideas being expressed in much of his fiction. As you say, the Screwtape Letters, the Narnia books, it's all over the place. This is one of the things I sort of discovered as I was really pressing into The Abolition of Man, how it feeds into almost every department of Lewis's output as a writer and thinker. You can understand, therefore, I think, perhaps why he says that The Abolition of Man is almost my favorite among my books, because it's the clearest he ever came to making a central statement of this belief in objective value, which, you know, after he came to accept that value is objective, well then, annoyingly, he had to believe that there was not just a natural law, but a natural law giver, God. And after he'd accepted that, then there's the natural law keeper and transcender, Jesus. So that's why it's so important for Lewis that value be recognized as objective. Because once you've got that in place, well, then you stand a chance of helping people towards belief in God and Christ, as happened with him. And therefore, it does infuse almost everything that he wrote. Thank you for the question.
So this will be the last one. And by the way, thank you to everyone who sent a question in. We got quite a number. I hope some of the other questions touched on some of the questions that people sent in. And apologies, there's simply not enough time to get to all these. But I will. We mentioned your incredible movie career, Michael. So I will come full circle with this one. Have you ever been contacted by Hollywood as a consultant for any of Lewis's film adaptations, and which of his works would you like to see as a feature or short-length film?
Well, when those original Narnia films were being made back in the early noughties, I did have a meeting with someone from Walden Media who said, oh, we ought to get you in as a consultant, Michael. But that never happened. Which is why the films went on to be so bad. Of course. Now, 20 years later, or wherever we are, Greta Gerwig is apparently under contract to make two new Narnia movies or adaptations for Netflix. And I'm doing my best to get on Greta Gerwig's radar. No success yet. But I'm hopeful. She has said in interview that when she was a girl, there were only two books that she constantly read and reread, and one was Little Women, which she adapted, I thought, very successfully a few years ago, and secondly, Narnia. Now, if she adapts Narnia as well as she adapted Little Women, I think it's going to be great. So she doesn't need my help.
All right.
And what was the other question?
That was good. I'm going to come up and give Michael a gift here. I mentioned he's one of now three people who have been here twice, and after he was here in 2009, I've reached out to him a number of times. He has an encyclopedic knowledge, as you can imagine, of Lewis's writing, and so when I've wondered about a particular passage that I can't find, I've written to him many times. The first time I did that, I said, Hi, Michael. This is Pastor Tim from Plymouth. You may not remember me, but you came and spoke at a thing called the Faith and Life series. And he very quickly responded and said, oh, yes, I remember you very well because the plaque you gave me is in my kitchen. I use it as a hot plate. And so now, Michael, you will have two.
Thank you.
So this is a bit of granite. It's probably identical to the one you got before, except for the years. It says, with thanks to Michael Ward for bringing faith to life. We are so grateful for your time with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Thank you very, very much.
Yeah. It is ideal.